Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the STEM Files on Blog Talk Radio, where we highlight the best and the brightest in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I'm your host, Tariq Muhammad, the Chairman and Chief Science Officer of Original Man Scientific. My co-host is not with me. He's traveling right now, so please keep him in your prayers and having safe travels. This is actually the one-year anniversary of the STEM Files. We started last year, October 1st, on a Saturday. So this is a one-year anniversary. I'm very excited about that, the 25th episode. And today's guest is a friend I met a while back when we were teenagers, and I love seeing how far he's come and what he's been striving to become. Online, we have Kushik Mantripragada. What's going on, man?
Nothing much, man. How about for you?
Not much, man. Not much. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pronouncing your name, last name correctly, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, awesome, awesome. Great, great. So, Kushik, man, if you just come, give us just a brief background of yourself and where you are now in your particular area of STEM.
Sure, sure. So, yeah, well, let me just start off with, just saying how glad I am to be a part of this show. Thanks for inviting me, Tariq. I'm going to start off with the Bank of America. So we met during the Bank of America Leadership Summit. From there, I went to college. I went to UNC, and it really stimulated me in terms of so my passion was always neuro, the brain, essentially because my grandfather, who was in the village in India, had a neurodegenerative disease, and not many resources were available to him. So I started off with my passion being in neuro, my experiences at UNC only kind of expounded upon that. I met a lot of individuals and a lot of people that kind of pushed me towards the path I am here. I was a psychology major at UNC, and I researched eating disorders. I was on part of a team that researched eating disorders, and we were just very, very interested to see how the process of recovering, because mostly eating disorders are, at least in terms of the medical perspective, eating disorder is, have you met a certain weight limit? After you've met the certain weight limit, it doesn't become, it's not more of a medical problem, it's a psychological problem. And so what we were kind of interested in doing was kind of pairing the two together, because ultimately the person who's experiencing the eating disorders has to, feel better for the eating disorder to be treated. From there, essentially, I went on to medical school at FAU. I'm currently in medical school. I'm a first year now. 9 weeks in, almost 9 weeks into medical school.
Great, man. That's great. And this is awesome, because you spoke about you said your grandfather having a neurodegenerative disorder. And
that's correct.
At what point, coming up as a child, at what point did you realize, okay, this is what I want to get into? Were you a teenager? Were you a little bit younger than that? When did it start?
So, I remember, I think it was when I was in middle school. My parents were telling me how my grandfather had experienced this second childhood, essentially, where he was recounting events that happened in his childhood. He was acting like a kid. And I was always like, I always felt like I was so powerless. I wanted to do something to help him get better, and I just couldn't do anything. And so that was pretty much the starting point that led me to realize, I wanted to do something related to the brain. So, to answer your question, it was in middle school about.
Got it. It's funny because my grandmother, she didn't die, because, we always had this connection when we met at the Student Leader Summit. We had this connection because we both wanted to be doctors, and I was the cardiac and you were the neuro. And so it is crazy, because my grandmother She didn't necessarily die from a heart condition. She just died. Her heart gave out because of the surgery she had. She was having. Her heart wasn't strong enough to sustain the surgery. And I always just kept thinking, you know, man, if I had knew more at that time, you know, she'd be here or whatnot. Having knowledge of something and, you know, wishing that you could have done more, or even at the time of having the knowledge and your family member was going through that, just wishing, just knowing, you're just not being able to separate the emotion from the knowledge. Can you speak on a little bit more on that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, they always say hindsight's 20/20, right?
Right.
And having the knowledge, it's really powerful. And sometimes you're right, the emotion does get in the way of, you know, both having the knowledge and using that knowledge. But in terms of, you know, I think it's so basically more in terms of my grandfather, when we were, you know, showing him to the doctor and things like that. They didn't really explain to us what his current condition was. But later on, in fact, actually senior year of college, I found out that he had dementia. And his dementia was because of, so there's brain, or in his brain, there was a water accumulation, or like fluid accumulation, rather. So hydrocephalus is what it's called. And,
Right.
you know, like you just feel extremely, but now that you know, you just wish you could have shared this knowledge, you know, to your grandfather, maybe help your family in terms of how or what he was going through, because my family didn't understand most of it. And it's sad that this happens frequently, right? You know, you're not just treating the patient, you're treating the patient and the family.
Right.
And so I think it's important for the emotion and knowledge to come together, especially when you realize that you're treating not just the patient, but the family as you know, as a whole. And I think it could have been very useful if I had known something about, you know, hydrocephalus or dementia or the brain. You know, if I had known something about it, I definitely would have tried to share. And you know, at the time, it didn't know much. You know, by the time my grandfather died, I was only a sophomore in high school. So he, you know, it was way too advanced for me.
Right. Well, you know, definitely, God definitely puts things in our lives. He doesn't make a mistake at what time period he puts things in our lives. You know, it's just that it's just whenever it's time, you know. And it's really
That's
up to
correct.
us that when we, you know, get the knowledge in the future, just be able to use it to help someone else, you know. And
Right.
you know,
Yes,
you
definitely.
spoke about yeah, definitely. You spoke about doctors not just treating the patient, he's treating the family. Do you think that has a lot to do? Do you think that if all doctors did that, it'll be the rate at which people would pass on would be a little less, and it'll be a more family environment in the hospital or in the medical environment?
Yeah, I think if doctors, and I'm there, you know, it's wrong to say that all doctors don't do this, right? There's some doctors that definitely do treat the patient as a person, but some doctors, you know, they seem to see the patient as more of a disease, right? A walking disease.
Right.
And if
Right.
they do treat, if they begin to treat the patient as a person, they start respecting the patient a little more, which is what we're learning in medical school today. You know, the new curriculum is very focused and oriented towards that, being more accepting and also treating the patient as a person as opposed to a disease. You know, for example, we don't say, oh, person X is an anorexic, right? You say a person with anorexia nervosa. So I think there's been a shift, but I do agree in the terms that if we did do that, and if we started involving the family more, it'd be extremely efficient. Because, you know, you only see the patient maybe what, an hour when he comes to, you know, when he or she comes to your office, but the family may be more involved in taking care of this person. So it's definitely important to involve the family, depending on how close people are.
Right. Okay. Cool. And when when you, you know, when you're finished with medical school and everything, you know, you do your resident, your internship, your residency, and perhaps a fellowship. Where exactly, how far do you want to take your career? Do you want to stay in the hospital, or do you want to kind of go to the private area as well?
So I really haven't been thinking about that. I like to take it a couple steps at a time, but you know, if I were to give you an answer, I think it'd be more hospital oriented, because I don't see myself, if I were to practice private, it'd be kind of hard for neurosurgery, especially since you'd have to affiliate yourself with a hospital. And,
right.
You know, there's other considerations, especially since the hospital mainly pays your malpractice as a neurosurgeon. However, if you're not, if you own a private practice, you have to pay your own malpractice, which is not, you know, a small amount
for some of these surgery
specialties. Not cheap. So,
yeah.
You know, that's a consideration. But, you know, I want to say, yeah, I want to say I'd like to be in the hospital, maybe even academic medicine. I'm not too sure for the academic perspective of it. But I do definitely want to go back to India after, you know, I practice and, you know, once maybe I'm retired or maybe during my career, go back to India and, you know, serve the village my grandfather's from, because to this day, you know, there's still not many resources in that village. And, you know, that's just one village, right? I mean, there's so many areas like this that are so, in terms of health access, they don't have much access. And it's sad. So hopefully, you know, that's what I want to see my career kind of meld into, this global health type of medicine.
Awesome. Have you been traveling? I know you're in your first year, so have you been able to see any, go like travel to any other countries and experience the medical quality over there? Or
yeah, I have. So I think maybe every 2 years I go to India. Just that summer actually, I went to India, and it was different because I went to Nepal and Tibet as well. This was part of a religious trip. And it was, so there's this mountain, it's called Mount Kailash, where we believe one of our gods exists. I went to that area, and we went to, in Nepal, I mean, the situation was extremely dire. One of these places that we were stuck in this region, because essentially, if you have any wind at all, the helicopter flights don't take off, because there's been a large reporting of accidents if there's any slight wind, even if your skin could barely be your hair could barely be lifting, and they just cancel all flights. And so we were stuck in this very, very rural area, very impoverished area. It was extremely dusty. You know, there's no road. It was just dust everywhere. I see these kids, since we were part of a travel group, we had water, we had food, and you know, things like that. And these little kids, they tried to sneak into our camp and get water and be so happy, or like, you know, get a little piece of food that, you know, we're not even feeding them. They're taking food from our leftovers, or not from our leftovers, rather our waste. It was sad to imagine. You know, if the food and water, like access to food and water, is that bad, imagine if or at all there is any healthcare access in that region at all. The main source of income for these people is tourism. And you know, even when there were several people that fell sick in our group because of the altitude changes. And, you know, there was no real doctor that came to see them. It was just our tour guides. They were giving us the medications. Now, luckily, we had two doctors in our group, but it's not good, especially in areas like Nepal.
Wow. And there are tons of places all over the world like that, man. And do you think that is something that you would want to be more active in once you're done with med school?
I definitely think so. You know, I really would like to get active and involved in that. Just because I don't think it's right to have you know, to be, for example, to be a child and, you know, not know that there's something better out there, or maybe just to be a child and, you know, be afraid that if you go outside and play, you know, you might get sick and, you know, that's the end of it. It's, you know, essentially you're robbing this child of his future, his or her future. And I think that's extremely wrong, especially if you can avoid it, and which I think is easily avoidable if, you know, you go out there, you practice medicine in these rural areas.
Right. Wow. And, you know, speaking of children, man, let's go back to when you were in high school and going into undergrad. Now, I know you're from Florida. From Florida going to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So tell us about the journey there. How did you end up in North Carolina?
Yeah, so basically, my first year, I went to University of Miami. I wanted to challenge myself more, and I wanted to get into public health. So that's why I transferred over to UNC my second year. And from my second year onwards, I was at UNC. My interest for public health was mainly what stemmed it, because UNC has a very good public health program.
Okay. Awesome. So University of Miami, was that your first choice, or was that the school you were selected, or how did that?
Yeah, at the time, University of Miami was my first choice, and you know, it slowly changed as I started to, you know, feel like I had more of an interest in public health. So essentially, the program at UNC, or at Miami rather, was a more business-oriented health administrative perspective, whereas the public health program at UNC was more, you know, just that, public health. It was more involved in the community. And, you know, unfortunately, things didn't work out. You know, I realized slowly after I took – so basically I had an internship in the sector, and I was a reimbursement assistant. So essentially what I did was I would call insurance companies and state, oh, for example, that this doctor was mischarged was not paid correctly for his or her services. That was what the day would consist of. And, you know, slowly I realized, you know, I wasn't really interested in that type of job, mainly because it starts getting monotonous. You're not actually talking to people. You're talking on the phone with someone you don't really know. And that's kind of what did it for me. So slowly I realized, you know, there's a lot of this that's going to be happening in that sector. So I realized, you know, maybe that wasn't my interest, but, you know, thankfully everything worked out in terms of, you know, finding another route.
Okay. Awesome. So going from UNC Chapel Hill to Charles E. Schmidt, how was that process?
Yeah, so the medical school process is daunting, to say the least.
Yes.
It's easy to be misinformed. You know, there's websites out there that are basically forums of, you know, just anxious, nervous pre-meds that are all going through the same process, and it gets very, you know, when you look at these forums, you start realizing, you know, you start getting more stressed, you start getting more anxious. And that pretty much sums up the whole, you know, process in terms of medical school, applying to medical school. You know, I applied to a lot. I actually applied pretty late. You know, if going back, I would have applied earlier. I applied around September-ish when I hit the submit button. And, I interviewed at Charles E. Schmidt. I interviewed at a couple of schools. I interviewed at Charles E. Schmidt, and I kind of, you know, fell in love with the school because the surroundings are beautiful. I remember the day before interview day, it was 9 o'clock p.m., and we were just driving around. I was just amazed at how beautiful everything was and, you know, how kind of peaceful it was. And then when I actually attended interview day, it was – so we have a PBL curriculum, so that's problem-based learning, where we're given like sample cases and like sample patients, and we learn our material off of those sample patients. And I just believe that that's how I learned. And I was lucky enough to be experienced or, you know, be exposed to something like that at UNC where we had the flipped curriculum. So we kind of taught ourselves. And then what happens is the teacher asks you questions and builds upon that material. And that's the same way we're doing it at FAU. And so that's really what kind of motivated me choose this specific school. And we have an extremely small class size. So, you know, luckily I was, I found it, and I knew from interview day that I was going to go here. And, you know, look, everything worked out. So I'm glad.
Wonderful. And now, plus you get to go back to Florida, right?
Yeah, I do get to go back to Florida, not too far away from home, so it's nice.
Great. So the interview process, it's definitely the applying for medical school can get pretty expensive, and I know that if you apply to more than one or several, it's definitely expensive. So how was that process, just kind of overcoming all the financial potential financial burdens and the struggle when it comes to just getting the application seen or even the interview process? Was everything, you know, pretty much a smooth ride, or were there some obstacles along the way?
There were many obstacles for me. So essentially what happens is you submit your primary. In your primary application, you select, say, X amount of schools. I think I applied to about 20 to 25. And then you start – so once you submit your primary, your secondary start trickling in. And I think everybody gets a secondary. There are some schools that I applied to that were selective, and they select you before you get your secondary. So for example, I think UC San Francisco selects before you get your secondary, and Mayo Clinic is different as well. You know, they have different fees, so they don't have an actual secondary. They have your primary application, for example, and after the primary application, they go through several rounds of reviewing, and then they ask you to submit your letters of recommendation, at that time, you're going to have to pay another fee. So most of these schools, that's what they have. So once you submit your primary, you pay your fee for each school, then you submit another fee for your secondary applications. So a lot of, you have to start crossing off certain schools, or basically really filtrating your list of schools, because like you said, you know, it does cost a lot, especially when each application to each secondary application is $100, maybe even more, upwards of that for some schools. And you know, the primary application was pretty expensive as well. You know, that's in the thousands. So it does get up there. That's where filtrating and knowing what you like in a school gets important, because you have to, it's a two-way process, right? You know, it's not just, oh, wherever it'll take me, I'll just go there. You kind of have to be extremely active searching for schools and realizing, okay, this is what I want. And that shows, right? That'll show in terms of even in your secondary application or interview day. So you just make sure, if I were to give advice to any pre-medical students out there, I would just make sure to know what you want in a school and convey that.
Okay. Now, when you were younger and you made the decision, okay, I want to be a doctor, so I'm going to do everything I can to become one. When you were younger, did your parents support you? How did they react to your decision?
Yeah, my parents were always supportive. I remember when I was like maybe in third grade or so. So we spent a lot of time at Barnes & Noble's. And there were always these little books. I think the DK books, like these encyclopedias, like little pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. And whenever we went to Barnes & Noble's, I'd always just get one and ask them to buy it. And, you know, they'd always buy small books like that. You know, they always made sure that I had enough resources to advance in terms of knowledge. You know, they always also challenged me, made sure I was if some curriculum was too easy and they knew that I felt it was too easy, they'd always make sure that I had sufficient challenge. And to a large part, or in a large degree, I think the reason I'm going through medical school and where, like, you know, where I am now, my position now, is essentially because of my parents and how they supported me. They never let, for example, if I wanted to buy a book, or, you know, if I wanted to buy something that would stimulate me, you know, in terms of knowledge, they never said no. That was very, very, very supportive for me. I go to my parents with everything, you know, when I have issues, when I have stress, when I teach them something, like I learned by teaching. So when I teach them something, they're always listening to me hours and hours on end, even though they don't know what I'm talking about, essentially. Yes, my parents have been very, very supportive. And they never questioned that I wouldn't be, like, when I started showing, I guess, I mean, you know, we say started showing signs, but, like, because I was so interested in science, they never pushed me in a particular route, but when I did decide that, you know, I wanted to go into medicine, they were always there for me, even throughout the interview process. The interview process turns you into, you know, from a normal person, it turns you into someone that's very, very, very nervous, right? My parents were there for that time, too, and they always supported me. My mom always said, you know, you're going to get into medical school. You're going to get into medical school, and, you know, here I am. I got into medical school essentially because of my parents.
Oh, man, that's beautiful. And I can definitely attest to that, having parents that that feed what your desires are, especially if it's positive. You know, my mother, as long as it was something that was positive and that can help make the world or your community a better place, she was all for it, and she did whatever she could to support it. And just speak on how important it is for young people to have support in their endeavors, especially if their endeavors are not only will change their own lives, but change the lives of others.
Yeah, I think support's very important. You know, support doesn't just have to be from parents. You know, support can be from mentors, and there have been many mentors on my route. Support is extremely important, right? You can envision your goal, and you're going to have 1,000 ifs, buts, and what ifs. But if someone believes in you as well, you know, that's just an added, it's an extra boost. It'll get you to where you want to be much faster in a much more efficient way. So I think support is absolutely necessary for young people. And, you know, sometimes, and I understand that sometimes there isn't the support, and that's very unfortunate. And in terms of that, you know, in situations like that, there are things like, for example, BOA, right? The Leadership Summit was extremely supportive in terms of being able to, it essentially taught me not to go, like, you know, to rely on other support systems, but to go find my own support is what I learned from BOA leadership. So there are programs out there that are free of charge, right? BOA was then instead BOA paid us. There are these programs that will help you find support. And I think if support is not available, that the person should do his or her best to find support in other avenues.
Awesome. So in terms of your mentors, who would you say is that played a very huge role in the kind of, in just where you are now? Is there any particular person that you can kind of pinpoint that was really, you know, influential and did things in support of you and so forth?
Yeah. You know, obviously my parents are my first mentors. But you know, aside from that, the most recent mentors I've had were a group of doctors that I shadowed at UNC. They were ENT surgeons, and their work, what they did was just so astounding. You know, the first day of shadowing, for example, I saw someone's hand muscles be substituted. So this woman had a portion of her tongue eaten away by cancer. It was, you know, the cancer spread to the tongue, so they had to remove it. And the surgeon substituted the muscle of the hand into her tongue, and now she has full functionality of her tongue. And that was, my mind was blown away. And when I asked more and more questions about procedures like this, and, you know, I always had more questions about just anatomy, about the person, about medical practice in general. The surgeons that I shadowed at UNC were always there. They always answered questions. And, you know, one day I really do hope to be a physician that's as good as they are. You know, one of these surgeons, for example, he, like, you know how paperwork is very, it's becoming more of a part, it's playing a more prominent role in a physician's day-to-day duties. Now, this surgeon, he would, so unfortunately, because it takes up so much time, it would take away from, you know, patient time. So what this person would do was he would see his patients during the day, and then he would write his notes after a hard day at work that involves surgeries, pre-ops, post-ops, and, you know, everything, the whole nine yards. After that, he would start with his notes. And, you know, I mean, during the day when he had 5 minutes, for example, he'd always do the notes. And but I would see him in his office till 10:30 at night. And then he'd go back and then he'd come home. And then he'd go back to the office at 6:30 a.m. to start it all over again. And, you know, I think he was – I was very influenced by how he practiced medicine. He was very observant. Mm-hmm. There was this one patient that was in our room, and she was, for example, she wasn't really smiling or laughing at any of the jokes. And he was able to pick up on that immediately, you know, whereas, like, when he asked me what I thought was wrong with this, you know, person, I was like, oh, maybe it's a nasal deformity of some sort, or, you know, I thought I automatically jumped to that, but he took the whole person into account. He observed the whole person. And I thought that was astounding. And, you know, that's what I want to become eventually, a surgeon or a physician that can see not just the disease in front of them, but the person as a whole.
Right. Wow. Well, definitely, you're definitely well on your way. And just from the type of qualities you have now, man, I can definitely see you being that and more. So, man, I definitely wish you well in your journey. And
thank you, man.
Just coming from, I want to talk about the other side of medicine that there's some take for granted, and it's really important in understanding science and then contributing your knowledge and your findings to it, and that's research. And I know you mentioned earlier in the show that you did research regarding eating disorders. So tell us what that was like, and how did you get involved in that particular area of research?
Yeah, so basically it all started when as a sophomore, I was taking abnormal psychology with this one professor, and I really was amazed that, you know, because she was a clinical psychologist. And clinical psychology is very similar to medicine in that they do treat patients. And in some states, clinical psychologists are also licensed to prescribe certain medications. And when I was talking to her, her interest in eating disorders kind of rubbed off. And I was just, you know, astounded that not only eating disorders, it doesn't just have a psychological perspective, but it also has a biological perspective into it. And that is, you know, how hormone levels are interacting and how it's kind of, you know, plays into the whole milieu of symptoms, right? It's essentially when a person with anorexia, a person has anorexia or nervosa, some of the, I guess, behaviors are not conducive to regular diet, right? So, for example, they'd have increased ketosis. Because they're not able to eat, or they're not eating a sufficient amount, and you know, it's really sad in that the psychological perspective is extremely important. You know, so oftentimes people with anorexia nervosa feel that there's no other aspect that they can control in their life, and eating is the one thing that they can control, so that becomes the one thing that they control. And they often starve themselves. And it's sad, but, you know, it's interesting to see how hormone levels like ghrelin or leptin, for example, could play a part how people with anorexia nervosa behave. There's also new and interesting research that's coming out now that's saying, you know, part of the gut microbe, like what you eat, can determine your mood as well. There's bacteria in your gut that can produce serotonin, and you know, serotonin is a neurotransmitter that has a wide array of functions, but one of the functions seems to be elevating your mood. So it's just interesting to see all of that. Now, to a large degree, as a research assistant in this lab, I saw the psychological portions, but whenever I wanted to see the biological portions, or, you know, what was going on behind all the data that I've seen, my lab instructor or my principal investigator was always open for me, and she always opened that avenue. She always told me, you know, here are some resources, here are some things that you can do to get more about this. And I think she was she played a large role as my mentor too, because she opened up so many resources for me.
Amazing. Okay, cool. So, and what did being a research assistant, what did that do for your understanding of medicine and of science as a whole?
So yeah, research is, so as a research assistant, you know, I wasn't really going into it. I was never, you know, kind of the research type of guy. I felt that research was, you know, I always imagined research to be crunched up in the lab, and I just be in the lab for hours on end. And, you know,
right.
I never liked, for example, writing science reports. I was never one for, doing any of the experiments, especially since so many people were scared that the experiment may go wrong and boom, there goes your grade. But, you know, when I got to be a part of this, my perspective changed in that. So there, as a research assistant, as an undergraduate research assistant, I was mainly doing data entry or helping run some of the other projects that we had. We had a generation study that we were doing. So we looked at anorexia nervosa in three different generations as well. And, you know, I was mainly part of the data entry. And, you know, obviously there are tiers, right? There are levels to what you need. You know, the beginning, the entry level, that's where the undergraduates come in, right? It's going to be data entry. But from that data entry,
right,
you could always see there's some patterns. So you got to kind of pay it forward to be more involved in the research. So, yes, there are always these patterns in data entry. We had these talks on Friday where we would discuss more important research and different concepts about anorexia nervosa. So that was always interesting. Unfortunately, later on in the semester, I had other commitments, so I couldn't always make those, but, you know, that always stimulated me. So it's just an interesting perspective because you're talking to the expert in that area. So when you talk to the expert in that area, like, there's something in psychology called the zone of proximal development. So that takes the student, which is, you know, say, for example, a small circle in the middle, and the instructor is a larger overlapping circle that covers the small circle but much more area beyond that. My instructor or any research instructor took my understanding from that small circle and expanded it a little bit.
Okay. Cool, man. And I personally, just coming from someone who's been in the research thing for about 5 years now. Matter of fact, I started the same year I met you at the Bank of America Summit. This being so, you know, wrapped up in it, I for one did not like the writing and the reporting and everything like that, and just, you know, the boring stuff.
Yeah.
I was always right. in love with what the things that happened in the lab, the things you got to see, the changes you saw. Those are the things I enjoyed in the lab and still do. And, you know, just being able to say, okay, I did research on something and it was successful, and then a more established scientist can go behind me and repeat it. You know, so that's something that's really cool. And just
the important thing to realize is that in science, you're not trying to prove something right. You're trying to prove something wrong, right? You're trying to disprove something. And there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun in challenging concepts.
Absolutely. Definitely and it brings out a lot of things in you too. Like you were saying earlier, it definitely helps you grow. You find out a lot of things about yourself you may not have known, like your level of patience.
Right.
You definitely find that out real quick. And definitely a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, you find out a lot about yourself, like you're saying, in the process, right? Like, I found out I wasn't a big, I wasn't big on data entry. I didn't like that part of it,
Right.
But, you know, there are these tiers. Like, going in, I thought, you know, I was going to be doing a lot of more of the research side of things, as in, like, more of the non-data entry stuff, you know, running the actual projects, talking to the actual people. And to a degree, that was there. Right, but there's always these tiers, and you've got to pay it forward to be over there.
Absolutely, man. So you're definitely paying your dues and making sure that you have all the tools possible to be a great doctor. And do you actually see yourself doing more research after med school, like taking on more research projects on your own?
Yeah. So a short aside is that the surgeons that I was talking about at UNC, they were practicing clinical medicine, right? But a large portion, like, my mentor actually did publish some research, and the research that he published was more clinical based. So I do see myself taking part in research like that, clinical research, as opposed to more of the basic science. Now, see, that's where, you know, the tough portion of it comes in, because so much in neuroscience is very, you know, the basic science aspects of it, right? What receptors are, you know, doing what? Like, what does the G-protein-coupled receptor do and things like that? So, you know, I think hopefully I'll find some type of balance, but I definitely do want to do research. But, my view is that the physician – in general, regardless of whether the physician publishes research or not, is a researcher, because the physician has to research his or her community, right? Nobody else knows the community better than the physician, nobody else should. And so you're at that point, you're researching your community, you're observing patterns, you're making conclusions, you're making hypotheses, you're constantly being proven wrong, and you have to be open to be constantly being proven wrong. If I want to be a physician, I'm going to be a researcher.
And that's a great attitude towards it, man. And it's a great perception of how important research is, man, because a lot of, you know, I'm speaking to doctors and medical students, and some of them aren't necessarily keen to how important research is, or even want to incorporate it into their practice. But if they really look at it, like you just said, it's a huge part of their practice. You know, you can't, there's no way of getting around researching something in any shape or form. So thank you for kind of shedding some light on that, man. All right, cool. So let's not talk about science for a while. Let's talk about the things you've done, you know, outside of medicine. So tell us more about your work with Phi Sigma Pi. Well, please tell me if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, that's right. Phi Sigma Pi. So Phi Sigma Pi is the honors. It's the honors fraternity. So essentially, to be selected, you have to meet certain GPA requirements, and then you go through a process. It's called Rush. You go through Rush, and you know, you eventually get invited as a brother. Once you get invited as a brother, you go through a learning process where you learn about the fraternity, about what resources the fraternity has to offer, and how you can make yourself a better member. And once you finish the research, or like once you finish your, like, I guess, research phase of being a brother, you know, you get to be eventually a brother. So Phi Sigma Pi is, you know, it has both genders, right? And it's a non-inclusive fraternity. Non-inclusive fraternity. So, you know, boys were in there, girls were in there. You know, everybody could join, regardless of what their gender or sex was.
Oh, that's interesting, because
so,
you usually associate that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So usually fraternities are more associated with male members, right? This fraternity was quite different, which kind of, you know, I felt more appreciated and when I was rushing, so I really wanted to join. And when I joined, there were a lot of things that we did. We were we were always trying to get ourselves out there. We're always trying to get ourselves involved in the community around us. You know, that could come through volunteering at the soup kitchens or setting up a fundraising event to go towards all our fundraising goes to something called Toby. So Toby is where some of the disadvantaged kids can have an opportunity to learn more about leadership. Like one of the programs that I was talking to you about, like BOA kind of. So some disadvantaged kids, some people from high school. So essentially these kids from high school or middle school, both are involved, and we have this event, and this event will, you know, help them broaden their horizons a little and maybe get that support that they need. We would organize the fundraising for that. And a big thing that we used to do is it's called Battle of the Bands. So that would take place every spring. And, you know, there'd be other small events in the fall that we would just do for fundraising. So I was the IT chair. So I think being an IT chair really helps me get my feet wet with technology. So I was always big into technology, and especially since technology is there for the long haul, it might as well get oriented in it. And so that's what I did. A large part of any fraternity or any public organization in general is online presence. So I catered that online presence to specific populations that we were looking to get more involved with. You know, made the website. We also made an app. We had an app that was more for internal purposes, but you know, we were able to get a little bit of everything. So that's what essentially I did during my time with Phi Sigma Pi.
And that's why you had the IT chair position. You were just responsible for anything IT.
That's correct.
Okay. Awesome. So you have a IT background as well, and you were able to get, you know, more exposure and experience in other types of sciences. So that's pretty cool, man. So tell us about tell us about the Special Olympics and helping them with their training.
Yeah, definitely. So Special Olympics is, you know, I said this in my medical school applications, and I essentially say it to everybody. It really is actually a great experience. You know, it's fun. It's really fun. So I essentially was involved in a couple of sports. So I was in basketball. So I was a coach in basketball. I was coaching swimming and coaching tennis. You know, basketball and swimming, I was, you know, a little bit, you know, especially my sport expertise in that area wasn't as high, whereas tennis, you know, I could play tennis, and I played tennis for a while. So essentially what happens is we're each assigned to a team. So, for example, my team in basketball was Team C. We would essentially go to every one of the Team C's practices, get to know each person, and, you know, kind of just help them out, right? Just, you know, help if there's something wrong with the technique or if there's something that they're doing really well. And just it's a good chance to intertwine both sports and, you know, volunteering and getting to know your community. It was really great. I met a lot of people that were very excellent individuals, very determined. My first the first person I worked with, we're just going to change his name for, purposes, right? So I'm just going to call him Mr. X, right? So Mr. X was a very determined individual, right? We were swimming. This was during the swimming. That was my first interaction with Special Olympics. And he was so determined that it made me try to, he would swim. He wanted to win. He wanted to swim. He wanted to win. And at that time, my swimming was terrible. So I really wanted to make myself better so I could help Mr. X. And it was just – so it transforms you, I think, to a large degree. It transforms you because you're trying to help the other person. And there's so much you can learn from these people, right? Mr. X was so knowledgeable in so many things, right? Like, his passion was cars. He knew more about cars than anyone ever in that swimming pool. I learned so much from him. I learned how to be determined, how to not only face adversity, but make adversity a part of yourself and go on, which is the most important thing I learned. You know, it's easy to say, I can't do it because I have something, right? But each of these individuals are extremely determined. And even though they have some sort of disability, their disability is not a part of them. Their disability is only a part of their life, and they acknowledge that and they go forward. That's the type of motivation. That's the type of attitude that anybody should have, right?
Yeah.
With any goal, that's what'll get you from point A to point B. And, I was extremely, extremely humbled by the whole experience, but I got such, I was so encouraged by these people, and every one of them, every one of my friends over at Special Olympics, they always wanted to know what was going on in my life. So through the medical school process, they were always there for me. They'd always ask me, what's going on with the medical school application, where's that going, how are you doing? It's just there, you get to know a group of people, and that's why I wanted to come to medicine, right? You get to know a group of people more, you get to know and meet people, right? I got that through Special Olympics. I got to meet someone that I normally not have an opportunity to meet.
Wow. That's amazing, bro. And did you ever get to go to the to any of the big events where they receive medals and everything like that?
No, I was not. Well, I was able to go through because another thing where Phi Sigma Pi was involved with the community, right? So we also hosted one of these events for Special Olympics because there are several members that were involved in Special Olympics, and we wanted to all do something that was that brought both things, like the best of both worlds together, essentially. So we hosted an event where they competed, they got medals, and we got to hand out the medals. So it was great. Yes, I did. So to answer your question, yes, I did.
Okay, cool. Well, that's definitely a beautiful thing, man, to be exposed to, that level of service, man. And Was that – so I can't remember exactly when we were doing the BOA internship. I can't remember exactly. What nonprofit did you work with?
Yeah, so I worked with Suncoast YMCA.
Okay, got it, right.
Yeah.
Okay, and it was pretty much similar there too, right, working with the community and everything?
Right, we worked with the community. So we had three locations. It was me and so Caprice and I, Caprice was the other intern that worked in the same Suncoast YMCA as I did. So we went to three locations around the area, and we got to work with the community. We got to work with these individuals. And at the end of it all, we hosted one big event that brought all three of these branches together. And we just kind of showcased what each of the kids learned. And during the program. So one of the kids, he was very young. I don't really remember what age, but this kid could already read, and you know, reading would be taught maybe a couple grades down the line. So it was a couple of advanced children. And just, it was amazing to meet all of them. You know, I still remember, I have a lot of pictures from the event.
Yeah, me too.
And I still remember a lot of them. So, apart from the Suncoast YMCA, you remember we had this summit at Washington, D.C., where I got to meet you and, you know, a couple of other people. I believe Eric Tong, who was one of your he was a guest on this show as well.
Yeah, he was.
We met him through there, too. Yeah, and, you know, everybody's out there doing big things. So I really learned a lot through the whole process.
Awesome. It's funny you mentioned that because you're actually, you're actually the third person, the third BOA student leader from that year to be on the show.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I've had, you remember Jackie Flourishcar?
Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah. She's actually in med school too now as well. And she was on, I think maybe the third or fourth episode. Yeah, and it's,
okay.
It's just amazing just to see how many of us actually are going into the medical field and are currently in medical school or doing a career in medicine in some way. So it's definitely awesome to have you guys on to see just how much you guys kept your word to yourself that you would become or pursue, you know, a career as a physician. So I just want to thank you, man, for taking the time out to join us, man, on the show. I wish you could have met my co-host, Jabril, but no problem. And I wish you could have met Jabril because, matter of fact, he's usually on the show with me, but he's traveling. But if you ever want to come on the show again at any point, he'll definitely be on, and you guys can meet.
Definitely will do.
Awesome. So before we conclude the show, man, there's always one thing I ask all our guests. And it's if you were, you know, walking down the street and a random, like a 9 or 10 year old asked you, "Hey, Kushik, what does science mean to you? Like, what is science and what does it mean to you, and why is it so important to you?"
Right. Yeah. So I would respond. Science is a language. It's a language that requires a lot of translation. So as a scientist, your role would be to translate what you're learning or what you know enough so that the general public could understand that. And, you know, to a large degree, medicine is the same way. Medicine is a science that requires a lot of translation. So that way, the general public who, you know, may not have a high school education or may not have a middle school education for that matter, could still understand that.
Wow. Well, we definitely have a lot of different definitions of what science means to people, and that's why it's so incredible is that everybody has a different. It's not like, okay, like say for example, water. Water is going to be pretty much the same definition with everybody. It's going to be a liquid substance, H2O or however you explain it, it's always going to be the same. But if you ask somebody what science means to them, somebody will always have a different definition because science has touched these people in different ways. You know, it's so, yeah, man. So I definitely appreciate your time, man.
My big thing was always, you know, getting that science out. Science, it's important to get it out because I've been personally affected. My grandfather's been personally affected because that science wasn't translated in an accessible manner. So yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of people like that out there. And so it's important.
Absolutely, man. Well, you know, there's always this thing where, you know, and this is something else I wanted to ask you too, you know, in terms of just the role of science in the community and in just the general community. You know, a lot of times people take sports and entertainment on a higher regard than they do, you know, the sciences or anything that pretty much builds a community. What do you think? What are some of the ways that we can make science more important in the community and make it less of a, you know, "Oh God, here comes science, here comes math" kind of attitude.
Right. So The Kyoto science, you can never have science be like, you know, a science school where you have like 9 football players running and they tackle the whole concept, right? I mean, nobody would
right.
really want to watch that. I think it's that whole attitude may be because people don't understand it. Sometimes when we don't understand something, we tend to avoid that topic. So it's important to realize that if someone does have that attitude, it's important to educate that person. Okay, it's important
right.
that in a fun manner, right? In a fun way, it's something that's relatable to them, right? If I say
right.
When I was tutoring, so I was also involved in American Counts, and this is what I did when someone didn't understand math, for example, I wouldn't tell them, you just have to remember that. -9 + 9 = 0, right? You would
mm-hmm.
say, you would give them other things from their life, relate it to their life. So you would say, for example, if you were trying to explain fractions, you have 1/8 of a pizza, right? And I give you another
right.
1/8. How many slices do you have out of the 8? So things like that, you know, you just get it to relate to these people. And so by relating the knowledge and the concepts to this person, it's easier to get this person to understand and want to talk about science and want to talk about math.
Right. And, you know, and oftentimes, you know, do you think the person's condition, you know, and especially the condition of a community has a lot to do with it? Because if you think about it, a lot of times where you have a community that's struggling all the time, or people, you know, they're living check to check or what have you, sometimes you just want relief, and people turn to sports, and people turn to comedy, and people turn to entertainment to kind of relieve what the stresses or pressures that they have in their lives. Do you think that the types of conditions that are in these communities, do you think that affects the interest as well?
100%, you know. This does affect it, and we've seen many research, statement. It's not, and it's unfortunate, but you don't get that same relief, like a comic relief that you get from, say, a comedy movie. You don't get from science. You don't call something science relief, right? Science is very heavy to tackle. And I think it's important to relate any concept to the person and tailor it. I think that's what's being lost in today's education. You know, it's just very, you know, like, okay, here, you have to memorize these things. These things are going to be on a test. You have to memorize them.
Right.
Why? No, don't ask me any questions. Right. Like, you know, that's the type of curriculum that we're building, And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying every school is like that or every teacher is like that. There's a small number of cases that this is true, and this could mean, you know, this child's future is lost, right? This child doesn't realize that this is his area of interest. So it's important to relate, and it's important to give people support. If you see someone struggling in math, you want to know the reasons why. You know, just last week, actually, we learned if someone's not cooperative, in taking their medications, you have to ask why, because there's always reasons for these things. And if you ask, they will tell you. You just have to be able to listen. Once you listen,
right.
you can build a plan that fits that person.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, bro, you know, once again, man, I thank you for joining me this evening, man. And it's been a great time just catching up with you and seeing where you are. And I look forward to having you on again as a guest in the future, man.
Definitely, man. Thanks for having me. And I really appreciate talking to you after all these years.
right. Okay, cool, man. We'll definitely stay in touch. And I look forward to having you on again, probably maybe a little bit further into your into med school and see how things are changing for you and what else you've gotten into.
Right. All right, man. Thank you. Looking forward.
Absolutely, man. All right, everyone. This has just been another edition of the STEM Files on Blog Talk Radio. Our next guest on October 8th will be an architect out of Miami, with Florida native again. And just tune in next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and we look forward to everyone listening. Peace.